Hey everyone, welcome to episode 138 of the Lift Free and Diet Hard podcast. I'm your host, Andrew Coates, and I've been wanting to get Dr. Joseph Munoz on the podcast for quite a while now. We've chatted before about it, and Joey is a PhD of nutrition, and you've done postdoctorate, you know, even beyond that. You were very highly educated in the space, which is cool, and it shows in your media the way you approach it. You have a very strong following on sharing evidence-based primarily nutrition and battling a lot of misinformation, which there's going to be some fun here because this is a hard thing to do well. And you are a physique coach. There's a lot of stuff that you're doing in this space. So I'll let people find your social media because if I'm bringing you on, I want people to go check you out and see what you're doing. But here, first of all, welcome to the show. It's great to have you.
Thank you so much for having me, Andrew. I know we've been talking back and forth for quite some time, and I'm happy that we've had a chance here to catch up and have a conversation.
And as I always point out, for anybody who's got a podcast or even if doesn't, like, the biggest value of these things is I've personally benefited from just simply deepening relationships, getting to know people. A lot of people I started out with knowing from online first, get them on the podcast, then I've met in my travels, which is an eventuality, like a Jordan Syatt. And then there's some nice people I meet first and I bring them on. But you and I will meet at some point in person, like my friend Polly Campbell, who's your good friend. He's going to be on the podcast in the not terribly distant future. And I got to hang out with him at Raise the Bar just this spring. But here's the fun stuff. So I find a lot like nutrition, I swear. I don't know if there's anything as polarizing that can get us hostile, can get us combative, like shy of politics, than there is nutrition. Nutrition seems to be this like malevolent battleground. And I mean, we obviously know that the worst end, there's a ton of ridiculous misinformation. And that's your playground. And you seem to manage it by being measured. You don't seem to get involved in, like, I've never witnessed any like pitch battles or just like all out crazy stuff.
No, not at all.
How do you stay measured when communicating about nutrition? And I've got some stuff beyond that, but I want to start there.
Well, I think it's somewhat of a funny answer to that question because people have asked me that question before. And the truth is, Andrew, I just don't keep up to date with what other people are doing. Okay. So I somewhat stay out of arguments and being combative with people for those reasons. I try to serve my community as much as possible. And honestly, my ideas for content come from just asking my audience questions and making videos around those questions in particular, addressing those questions in a longer form format on my podcast. And really, for example, if there's some sort of debate between two big influencers or whatnot on social media, I usually don't even find out about those things till like way later because I simply don't follow a ton of people who I don't consider quality sources of information. So I don't even really stay up to date with a lot of those things. A lot of the controversial topics that I address come from topics that I know that people are confused about, right? Whether that's body composition or fat loss or more nuanced topics about specific effects of certain foods like dairy, right? Like people lose their minds over dairy or gluten or whatever that is. And those are just topics that I know that most people have questions about. So I address those. But I guess that's the way I stay fairly level-headed with it. I use social media more to educate and then for personal enjoyment, just watching funny stuff, honestly, more than anything else.
And that actually is a really good answer. It makes tons of sense because I think a lot of the time people, even if they're attacking the message, well, there's a messenger behind the message. But I realize you don't really attack the message. You get to the issue, right? You're talking about the topic. So that kind of cuts out maybe sometimes following or interacting with either the people who are doing the battle on the side of good. I think you do follow a lot of those people, but the other ones that we would not consider to be great evidence-based practitioners. So that makes a lot of sense. So do you think that, or what mistakes do you think coaches are making, especially when they get pulled into online arguments and battles, which you seem to have good boundaries around?
I think oftentimes it's an interesting question because I haven't given that much thought, but if I take a little bit of time to think about it here, I think one of the big issues is that oftentimes we forget what the purpose is, right? Although I would say some people maliciously share poor information for personal gain. I'd say most people aren't doing that purposefully. And most people who share a particular message that may not be accurate is probably thinking that they're doing a good job, right? And so, unfortunately, I think oftentimes the arguments get lost in personal attacks and not necessarily discussing the argument or the topic itself, right? Mm-hmm. And I think oftentimes too, people attack very small, like nuanced variables that really aren't all that important. And I'll give you a personal example. People like to attack me in my comments section frequently. I tend to just ignore all of it because I could care less, honestly. But I had this one person, and she was a PhD, or she was getting her PhD in nutrition, so highly educated individual. And I had made a video discussing why your metabolism is not the reason why you're struggling to lose weight for most people. And I was discussing how when people use the word metabolism, they're often referring to their basal metabolic rates. And so this person was playing semantics in the comment section saying, you have a PhD and you don't know what metabolism means. Metabolism is not just your BMR. It's all of these other variables. And I'm like, I know, but when people use the word metabolism, that's not what they're referring to. They're essentially referring to their BMR. And so I think oftentimes people try to attack a message to seem smart. Mm-hmm. And I think it's just a waste of time, honestly, right? I think in some cases, it's important to point out misinformation. And some people do it very, very well. My friend Adrian Chavez, I think, is somebody who does it perfectly. Because at the end of the day, there are bad characters putting out bad information. But for the most part, most people aren't doing that purposefully. And I think attacking somebody in a disrespectful way is never going to come to a positive solution because the person's going to take it as a personal attack inherently. I think that's probably the biggest issue. It's like personally attacking people versus respectfully disagreeing and having a conversation about the topic.
Couple things right here, because this is very relevant. I've observed, especially, like, I have 99.9% of my interactions online are overwhelmingly positive, great support. But it wears you down a bit if you allow the negative things to dominate your focus, which is human nature. And what some individuals do, and I've got maybe a couple of accounts that literally exist like this, they never interact in any sort of positive way, which is key. But they're there and they follow, but they pop up only to snipe at or attack. It is always a distortion of the message. It's never... My stuff is not polarizing. My media, anybody who finds it to be polarizing is looking for a fight. And so they exist to basically just wait until I say something that they disagree with or they can distort. And what they're doing, and I talk a lot about status games within the industry because it's a very human thing. They often are playing status games within their tribe, right? Their ideology, right? And it's usually kind of within their ideological sort of whatever framework. And they can build status by attacking people that they perceive to have substantially greater status. And their metric of status is often following, which is a very foolish lens to look at it through, but it's also a very human one. And oftentimes what happens is they are resentful. I've noticed I've gotten a fair bit of resentment from quiet corners because I've been able to grow a media following and I've been able to do a lot of other cool stuff like the writing. And whether it's they feel entitled to it or they do not feel I'm entitled to it, they'll look for opportunities to try to attack. And So number one, if someone isn't a consistent supporter who doesn't have a relationship with me already, then they have not earned the right to sit at my table and to participate in criticism, right? Even if they had been some good, you know, and some of it's bad, right? I'm just not interested in playing their games. I'm not going to play status games with anybody, and I'm not going to give them fuel to behave this way. But if someone hasn't earned any grace with me, then they haven't earned the right to my ear. Now, I don't tune out criticism, and I, generally speaking, objectively try to look at, all right, what's going on here? Is there something I can learn from this? And oftentimes it's like, okay, learn just not to do this a certain way to, you know, end up getting this negative attention. But these people just, I just cannot be drawn into their games. And for everybody listening, if you're afraid of this sort of stuff happening on online, if you can recognize that these people are playing status games within their thing, just don't play their games. Don't capitulate to them. Don't apologize. You can kind of look at it. You can pretty much mute, delete, block if you need to. If someone is very hostile, very disingenuous, then you can get rid of them. And I'm not talking about well-intentioned disagreement, like you said. I'm talking about malice. And oftentimes, and what people don't recognize is these people are bullies. Oftentimes they're bullies. And they act with under various ideologies, whether it's nutritional or social ideological, that shield them from actually being outed as what they really are, and they're bullies. And if you can identify that someone's a bully, guess what? Just ignore them. Like, just don't play their games. So anyway, that's something I want coaches to really understand. Now, I'll throw it back to you for your own experience.
Yeah, I think, you know, the word bully is very accurate, because the language being used is not respectful in any way. And the intent of the message is not to have a conversation, right? And I think you mentioned something very interesting, which is it's human nature to focus on the negative, perhaps. I also think it's human nature for some individuals to try to get ahead by bringing others down, right?
That is
what it is. I won't mention names, no. But there was a person doing their PhD alongside me when I was doing my PhD, and they started social media before I did. And they were growing fairly well on social media, and their only strategy was to bash very big accounts, bash very big credible accounts, I should say, where maybe they make a small mistake here or there, we all do, and they would roast them. And now, 2 years later, I don't have that approach at all. Again, following is not the only metric, but I have a substantially larger following, and I think partially is because I don't behave in that fashion. Interestingly, I think if we think of it from a selfish perspective in terms of how can we get ahead in the most optimal way, I'd say it's actually being nice and building good relationships with people who have larger followings with you, and really expressing what you have to bring it to the table that makes you unique and makes you part of the conversation, rather than trying to remove somebody else and take their seat, perhaps, which is the approach that these people are taking, right? Because if you look at most of the people that are bullies, they're not people with large followings. They're not people, even if we're not talking about following in terms of social media following, they're not people who have a lot of influence, and perhaps it is jealousy, perhaps it is some of these other variables. And the approach that they're taking is not helpful in any way. But it shows their true colors, honestly.
And it's good if we can get people to put these type of personalities into that box, then they become less threatening too. Because I think a lot of coaches are afraid to put themselves out there for fear of being attacked by these type of people. If you recognize them for what they are and realize, you know, okay, sure, they're trolls or they can behave like that. No, they're bullies, right? And bullying is not socially acceptable, right? And you can't use that to deflect legitimate criticism, but I think legitimate criticism comes in a different form. Now,
certainly.
You mentioned something that I really like, and how a lot of the stuff you see out there is well-intentioned but might be misinformed. So we all, anybody listening to this, considers themselves to be, you know, evidence-based practitioners. We know that evidence-based also can be an ideology that gets weaponized and to legitimize bullying behavior. I've seen it. But within what we consider to be credible, evidence-based, are there things that you find that good coaches who are generally well-educated are actually consistently misinformed about, that mistakenly think this is actually the fundamental understanding of the research and the science, and some of these ideas that maybe the regular coach believes? I'm going to give an example, although it's not specifically about nutrition. It's the thing where people will say, hey, it's illegal to give meal plans if you're not a registered dietitian. When in fact, and Goob, who, irony, now Goob attacks people, but Goob attacks people who are doing horrible shit. So Goob is allowed to do that because he's tearing down like literal sex offenders. But he's also called out a couple of my friends who I like, because they each had said it is illegal to provide a meal plan if you're not an RD. And Goob, lawyer by trade, has gone into the legislation virtually state by state, and, you know, certainly in America, and has completely debunked this, right? So that's an example of one of these. It's actually a false belief fundamentally, right? So, and I think RDs can sometimes be guilty of perpetuating this because, well, they are trying to keep that territory to themselves. And I think trainers can sometimes deflect it because they don't want to discuss nutrition at all. Now, I'm not saying most trainers are qualified or should be giving meal plans. Quite frankly, they shouldn't. But the fact that it's, quote, illegal, that's actually false. But anyway, so anything along those lines?
Yeah, that's actually a great topic that you brought up, because I don't know the semantics or the specifics of that. My general approach has always been, this is a sort of recommendation that you may follow, but not necessarily a prescription, right? And I think that's probably the approach that most people take, because for clients who don't know anything about nutrition, seeing what a day of eating may look like, seeing what a week of eating may look like is really helpful. But that's interesting that you brought that up. I appreciate that. I would say when it comes to the evidence-based space, the only topic that I could think about specific to nutrition that I think still there's a ton of confusion about is this idea of metabolic adaptation.
Okay, great. Let's do that one.
And in particular, this whole idea of your metabolism perhaps being damaged from yo-yo dieting or repeated bouts of attempting weight loss. And that doesn't seem to be the case, at least not strongly. You know, initially there were some studies showing that when individuals lose weight, their predicted metabolic rate after weight loss seems to be lower than what it, or their actual metabolic rate seems to be lower than predicted based off of predictive equations, right? Because we can take somebody's lean mass, fat mass, et cetera, and fairly accurately predict where their metabolic rate should be on a population level. Mm-hmm. And there was some data showing that repeated bouts of weight loss perhaps make your metabolic rate actually be lower than where it should be. And so people, you know, this whole idea of metabolic adaptation was a huge thing in the space. I still think it is amongst many coaches, and the idea of reverse dieting for the purpose of fixing your metabolism is really popular. Now, I'm a fan of reverse dieting, which is just a slow gaining phase, technically slowly increasing calories, but not for the reason of fixing or repairing your metabolism, right? What slowly increasing your calories really does help is increase your overall levels of activity, because we know that physical activity spontaneously increases if you're slowly eating more food, perhaps better performance in the gym, so you can adapt better to resistance training, you can have better overall body composition, which should make future weight loss or fat loss slightly easier. But when we look at the literature, the reason why we were seeing this quote unquote metabolic adaptation seems to come down to issues in the methodology of the studies. So most of these studies are assessing body composition using DEXA, right? And what we know is DEXA is the gold standard, but there are some limitations there. And hydration status is incredibly important for the readings of a DEXA, right? So what happens when you immediately finish a diet? Let's say you've lost 20, 30, 40 pounds, substantial weight. Immediately, the day you're done, you are depleted in glycogen. Right? You've been in a calorie deficit. Glycogen is the way you store carbohydrates. Your glycogen stores are low, which means that your muscles are more dehydrated than they would be if you weren't in a deficit, right? So the fact that your muscles are slightly dehydrated throws off the body composition reading. It actually throws it off to where it looks like you have less muscle than you perhaps actually do, because when you have water in the muscle, it shows up as more lean tissue, right? And essentially these errors in the methodology were an artifact or a confounding variable resulting in a metabolic rate that is slightly lower than predicted. There was an incredible study. I can't remember what year or group it was published in now, but what they did was test subjects immediately after dieting and then after a 2-week maintenance period. So after the 2 weeks maintenance period, they ate at maintenance. They were more well hydrated. Glycogen stores were repleted. And that metabolic adaptation essentially was no longer there. So a lot of the issues there are methodological. And that's one of the things that I really do see in the coaching space, because it's like, oh, let's reverse diet to improve your metabolic rate. And although the intent is good. And the thing is, I feel like it's perpetuated, because when you do slowly increase somebody's calories, there are some positive outcomes, right? So we tend to to say that those benefits are because of improvements in metabolism, which isn't necessarily accurate. And I know I'm getting into like specific nuanced semantics here, but that's one of the topics that really comes to mind.
And I want to pick out a couple of things here because I think this will actually help. So, All right. So I'll go here first. I want to make sure I'm understanding something so that way the listener can differentiate a few things. So what you're saying is there's a difference. The research doesn't support that the metabolism has been damaged more than what you would predict. Now, what would be predicted, let's say you have a situation where you have someone over the course of several years has participated in, you know, a lot of fad diets, a lot of aggressive dieting. Mm-hmm. In the absence of resistance training, which we know as people lose weight, they are going to lose some lean muscle mass and they're going to lose some body fat, which creates the illusion of better weight loss than or fat loss than they're really having. Repeated rounds of this over time, that person will lose enough lean muscle mass that's the thing you're predicting and accounting for the fact that they're going to lose metabolic capacity because they've lost muscle mass. Now, if I'm also understanding this correctly, over time, this person's metabolic rate is going to adapt negatively because they have less muscle mass. We're already accounting for that, correct? Like, that's a bad thing, but we're already accounting for that. There's no additional effect beyond the loss of lean muscle mass. That's correct? Good. Okay. Because I think that might-
Or the loss of total mass in general, because although lean mass is a component of metabolic rate, total mass is a much bigger predictor. Awesome. Right, so if somebody goes from 250 pounds to 200 pounds, their metabolic rate will decrease. The idea of metabolic adaptation is that it decreases more than it should. Mm-hmm. That's the aspect that doesn't really seem to be true, right? And there's been some really good review articles because the whole idea was people that have had experiences yo-yo dieting, right? Where they've spent years going on different fad diets, lose weight, gain weight, that those individuals metabolically have a harder time losing weight than somebody who perhaps hasn't yo-yo dieted. And that doesn't necessarily seem to be true. There's other issues, right? Whether they're psychological, whether they're dietary adherence, other variables, but definitely not a damaged metabolism.
Okay. And that's what I've come to understand too, because I remember there was a lot of hype, a lot of excitement about this.
Yeah.
And it makes sense. But there's things that have happened here. I mean, there was a lot of hype and excitement over intermittent fasting having potentially, you know, properties above and beyond its, you know, its calorie reduction that didn't turn out to be true. There's a lot of these different things. The belief in meal timing, you know, you go back far enough, we believe that meal timing seemed to be the holy grail of leanness, and there's nothing special about that either. And one of the things you said about reversing a diet up, I mean, one of the reasons why it's beneficial is because often it's not reverse dieting versus like something more moderate. It's reverse dieting versus like unrestrained, the old behavior, which was leading to, you know, fat gain in the first place, right? That it was just someone who had poor boundaries around the nutrition. And one of the reasons why we've seen classically fitness competitors rebound and balloon and regain a large amount of body fat shortly after a show is because if they're not reverse dieting, what they were doing is they were binging. And the classic coach wasn't working with them. Once get them on the stage, then everything else is your problem. That certainly changed in a lot of cases. But then those people basically were just, cool, now I'm going to eat everything under the sun because I've been restricted for so long. And then they turn around and they look around and they're like, holy shit, I've gained 30 pounds. And there was the old belief that this is actually like you were more sensitive to muscle growth at this time, when in fact it was overwhelmingly body fat because people were just eating far more than their needs.
Yeah, that's a really great point to bring up. You know, and when you asked me what are some of the topics in the evidence-based community that perhaps coaches still get wrong, it's tough to answer that question because I usually think of like people in the evidence-based communities as people who do understand these nuances. But I guess you're perhaps referring more to just coaches who are giving some of these recommendations, right? Absolutely. Some of the other things I can really think about, and I've fallen into these too, was the idea inherently from a resistance training component that free weights are better than machines for hypertrophy. I think that's one commonly perpetuated idea that still holds true amongst many coaches. And I used to strongly believe that just off the education I had off of YouTube before graduate school. and now I'm kind of on the other camp where I strongly do believe that machines, a very good machine, can be superior for hypertrophy specifically in many ways. compared to free weights because of the stability component, where you could really achieve muscular failure. Compared to like a squat, it's very difficult. You can reach failure, but how much of that stimulus is going directly to the quads versus going on a leg press to complete failure? The sensation is completely different, right? And I also used to think like the sensation doesn't matter. And that's also not the complete story either, right? But there's a lot of these small nuanced topics. I think really where people sometimes miss the point too is generalizing results from studies to everybody, where it really does need to be nuanced and population specific. And the reason I bring this up is because, for example, the anabolic window used to be super popular, right? Or this idea of protein spacing, evenly spacing out your protein throughout the day. If we look at the overarching evidence, it seems like it doesn't matter. And I would say for most people, it doesn't matter. However, we need to understand the limitation of that kind of research, right? It's conducted primarily in newer lifters. Newer lifters are going to respond really well to training compared to somebody who's a little bit more experienced. So that is potentially one confounding variable that confounds the effects of perhaps protein timing, because protein timing, if it does have a benefit, is going to be minuscule compared to the effects of resistance training and compared to the effects of overall protein intake, right? So the evidence pretty clearly shows that if you eat sufficient total protein throughout the day, it doesn't matter how many meals you spread it out throughout the day or whether you have protein before bed or after training. But, and this is actually a conversation that I've had back and forth with Eric Helms, who I respect gratefully, or respect tremendously, I should say, is that just because the evidence doesn't necessarily show those small nuances doesn't mean that it doesn't matter, right? Because one, population specific. Perhaps with more experienced athletes, it may have a slightly more pronounced effect. The other variable is that if something has, let's say, a 1% benefit or a 2% benefit, throwing out random numbers here, something like protein timing, for example, what kind of study duration do you really need to tease out those differences, right? Like, if I consume all of my protein, let's talk about extremes here, in just one meal, 200 grams in just one meal, versus evenly spacing it out in four or five meals. Will those differences really show after 12 weeks of resistance training? Probably not, right? Will they show perhaps after 4 or 5 years of resistance training? I would argue that it would, because again, theoretically and mechanistically, it makes sense. There just isn't evidence that follows a group of people for 5 years, right? So when I give recommendations to my clients, I like to provide that nuance because I think it's important. And I explain, I won't tell my client, hey, you have to eat your protein in four meals. Or I also won't say, hey, it doesn't matter. I'll explain this nuance because I think the information is important for the person to make an informed decision on what's best for their given situation, right? For me, I am obsessed with lifting. I want to squeeze out every single ounce of gains that I can out of my training. So I do evenly space out my protein. Some people just eat two meals per day. And so it probably doesn't make a huge difference, but I like explaining that level of nuance for those reasons.
And there's probably a lot of ways this shows up. I think another one is, as you mentioned, the anabolic window. I have religiously had a post-workout shake after every workout I've had. I would say 99.5% of the workouts I've had in probably the last 20 years. Now, is the anabolic window a myth? It's mostly a myth because, as I understand it correctly, I mean, we still are more insulin sensitive immediately post-workout, right? And we are going to benefit from having something that, you know, spikes our insulin and potentially blunts the cortisol spike of working out, right? I think that stuff's pretty solid. Like, correct me if I'm wrong. But A, for me, and, you know, 250-pound man, I still am of the camp that I do think it's beneficial to spread up my protein intake across the day. So it's easier for me to get those totals if I have more feedings. And one of those feedings is my post-workout whey protein shake. Also, in order to remember as a trigger to have creatine, I always put my creatine in my post-workout shake, which is easy. And I don't worry about rushing home and getting a meal, right? So I have the protein shake. And then if I have other stuff to do, then I have latitude for, you know, maybe getting that next meal. And whether or not the difference in timing between having the shake immediately post-workout or, you know, a meal 60 minutes later or a meal 3 hours later, maybe that effect is small, but just as you described, adding that up over a long period of time probably makes a difference. And sometimes if the habit of eating four regular meals a day to spread out your nutrition is something that keeps someone satiated, they're less likely to overeat on ultra processed high calorie food. If it fits into their routine, it's probably all a net win, because in these particular examples, I don't think there's any downside at all. Right?
There's no downside. Yeah, there's no downside whatsoever. And sorry, I cut you off there.
That's exactly what I wanted.
There's no downside whatsoever. And again, it's the black or white thinking of it matters, it doesn't matter, where the truth probably lies somewhere in the middle. And I love that you brought up the creatine thing. Andrew, I forget to take my creatine every other day, man. It's so sad. I'm like, I need to take my creatine, and I just forget. And then before bed, I run downstairs and grab some creatine. But, you know, with the post-workout feeding, the way I like to think about it is, sure, if you eat your total daily protein intake, it probably doesn't matter that much. And I think the evidence that we have right now is not sufficient to say it doesn't matter over a long period of time. As I explained, similar explanation to spreading out your protein. However, the way I like to think about it is, why not stimulate the recovery process as soon as possible? Why put that off? Right? Because we know that after training, like, we know there is no downside and there is a potential small upside. Mm-hmm. So if it's not a struggle to get your protein intake after working out, I do think it's a very worthwhile habit, even though the evidence shows that perhaps it doesn't make a difference. I do think it makes a difference long-term. Another really important topic that just came to mind specifically about nutrition, and I just recorded an in-depth episode on this topic in particular, is the idea of artificial sweeteners. And I don't want to talk about it from a health perspective, cancer, or anything like that.
Yeah.
I simply want to talk about it from a weight loss / weight gain perspective. Mm. There are people who are like, okay, I understand that there's evidence aspartame or whatever artificial sweeteners doesn't cause cancer, doesn't cause this, but it's probably going to cause people to want more sweet food and eat other stuff and gain weight. You know, that's one common argument that I see or that I hear. And I understand the logic behind it, but when we look at the evidence, that simply doesn't seem to be the case. There are some very well-controlled clinical trials showing the exact opposite, that artificial sweeteners may actually help with weight loss maintenance in particular, which is what people struggle with mostly, right? Most people don't struggle to lose weight. Most people struggle to maintain weight loss. And the theory behind that is that it's actually the exact opposite logic, where if you have cravings for sweet foods and you can curb those cravings with something that is still sweet, but doesn't have the caloric contents, and that can aid in weight loss. And people get really mad when I talk about this. There's evidence that for weight loss maintenance, it may be slightly superior than just drinking water. And people blows people's minds, right? And there's actually a very well-controlled study I can share with you if you'd like to read this, Andrew. But there was a year weight loss study, and two different groups both received education on caloric restriction and overall nutritional recommendations. One group was only allowed to consume just water. The other group was allowed to consume artificially sweetened beverages. Weight loss at the end of the year was more pronounced in the group consuming the artificial sweeteners, likely for the reason I just expressed. It's not that artificial sweeteners cause weight loss. The weight loss was different, but not a huge difference. Now, they followed up with them again a year after that, where they were no longer in this weight loss phase. And the individuals consuming the artificial sweeteners maintained substantially more weight loss than those just drinking water. And it's probably, again, because if you have something sweet, it curbs your cravings for other sweet stuff that has a ton of calories.
And we also have to look at it this way, too. I mean, the person who desires weight loss gained the weight at some point. How did they gain the weight? One of the things that often is playing a role is the overconsumption of like ultra processed drinks, right? Yeah. I'm doing a book. I actually got to recommend, because everybody would probably really benefit from this. It talks about a lot about the food, I would call modern anthropology of food consumption around the world. It's called The Way We Eat Now by B. Wilson. It was recommended to be by Mike Dola, the architect of Stronger You. He's a good friend. And I'm loving the book. And it goes into a lot of these things about just the way that, you know, different countries' consumption habits have changed, especially when you get the influence of multinational food corporations like your Nestle's, and the way that food, ultra-processed food, is marketed and how it's made available to children, to people, and how it's changed normal everyday eating behaviors in countries like Mexico and Southeast Asia and parts of South America and you name it, right? And it talks about a lot of different really cool concepts, but a lot of these sort of shifts, and both the some of the positives about, you know, food availability versus even in modern times, there's a lot of access to this nutritionally low nutrition, ultra processed food in some of these countries where there's an overabundance of calories, but an undernourishing effect of this food and a lot of the social complex social elements that go into this consumption and some of the deleterious effects that have happened. In particular, she goes into a lot of the stuff, how it played out in India was one of the places. So I would just suggest anybody reading that book is going to give you a really nice, robust anthropological sort of understanding of a lot of modern food trends and marketing and whatnot. Joey, this has been unbelievable. And obviously, like, these specific topics, this stuff is brilliant. I love this stuff. I try to stay informed, but I'm able to stay informed largely because I plug into people like yourself who are doing a good job of taking the research. I don't enjoy reading research, but I enjoy learning it from people who have a nuanced take, who are good communicators, science communicators, yourself, Eric Helms, Dr. Mike Izzertel. There's a very, very lengthy list of these people I think are wonderful. So I think one of the best things I can recommend is if people are interested in this stuff is to simply check out more of what you're doing and go follow you. So where do they find you?
Yeah, Andrew. And honestly, it's an honor to have my name mentioned among some of those individuals, because to me, they're legends. I'm fairly new in the game still. And so it's awesome to hear that you appreciate my work in that way. Everybody can find me on all socials at Dr. Joey Munoz. That's DR.JOEYMUNOZ. And my podcast is The Dr. Joey Munoz Show. I quickly really wanted to touch on something that you mentioned there about changes in the food environment. Most people don't know this, but I started graduate school as a food science major, which is very different than nutrition. Food science is like the science behind producing different foods and the properties of foods like texture, flavors, etc. I am of the camp that ultra processed foods do not inherently cause weight gain, right? Because it comes down to energy balance. That being said, though, I understand why the flexible dieting message can be harmful to people if you don't provide context. Because most people who do gain weight don't do so eating healthy, whole, and processed foods, right? So the issue with the ultra-processed foods is that they are literally engineered to be irresistible, right? So when I, the food science major really opened my eyes, because you think for example, Doritos or any chip company, they're just producing a chip, right? But the amount of research and development that goes behind making the perfect chip, so you purchase that chip and not any other, is insane, right? From the smell, to the texture, to the color, the appearance, the mouthfeel, the taste, the combination of sugar, salt, and fat, to the container it comes in, right? Like, it is literally manufactured so that you cannot put it down, and you have to have a lot of self-control, right? Even you and I, who know about this stuff and we're educated and we care about our nutrition, it's a lot harder to stop eating some potato chips than it is to stop eating an apple or some veggies, right? And it's because these foods are engineered this way. And it's, again, this isn't because food companies are evil. It's capitalism, right? If I can make the best product, I'm going to sell more of it. But I think it is important to provide that nuance, because although I teach my clients about energy balance and why that's the most important variable, I obviously recommend staying away from ultra processed foods as much as possible within the context of an overall healthy diet. And I'll end with that, because I like to talk a lot.
I often use the example of how I treasure and treat myself to one Dairy Queen Blizzard, DQ Blizzard, Reese's Peanut Butter Cup flavor, on Saturdays after my leg day is something I look forward to and I get to savor guilt-free, and that it helps me not eat more larger quantities of mediocre, high-calorie, ultra-processed stuff during the week. And that way, I can actually appreciate those sort of things in moderation that I truly treasure and not get caught in this cycle of just eating a lot of stuff that I will qualify as junk. Joey, you've been amazing. Go ahead, real quick, because I'm out of time.
I agree with you. If I'm going to have processed stuff, I just go for the stuff that I like. And I'd rather have that in lower quantities than like the intermediate stuff that doesn't even taste that good in higher quantities.
This is rubbish that we mindlessly eat. Okay, everybody, go follow Joey. You're going to love what he's doing. Thank you again for tuning in. If you're someone who's found me through Joey's media, all I got to do is take a walk through my other guests over the course of the year. There's 150 old episodes on top of the 138. I've had the who's who of the industry. Eric Helms is in there if you go back far enough. He's amazing. Lots of Dr. Mike Gizzartel. There's plenty more. Go check it out. And if you are one of my people, you got to go follow Joey and check out what he's doing. So thank you guys again. I appreciate you, Joey. And we'll tune in for another episode next week.